relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
It was not correct to ban Donald Trump. I think that was a mistake. Because it alienated a large part of the country and did not ultimately result in Donald Trump not having a voice. He is not going to be on Truth Social. I guess the answer is that I would reverse the perma ban.
He would revise the permanent ban of President Trump, my former boss. That voice from the ether is, of course, Elon Musk, the future owner of Twitter, future CEO. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First One-on-One. Delighted to have somebody in studio who's a true expert on that dastardly sector of the so-called media that is big tech. He is senior counsel for the Article 3 Project, formerly publisher of Ronald Reagan's favorite newspaper, Human Events. Will Chamberlain, welcome in studio.
Obviously, great to be here with you, Seb.
Well, now we have the luxury of a little bit longer to discuss. You were in recently because of a very powerful long thread you published on Twitter on the possible identity of the Supreme Court leaker, an individual who, in her past associations and writings, has shown quite a radical bent towards pro-abortion. Since we last spoke, anything changed in that analysis? Has anything countered that? I haven't seen anything.
No, there hasn't been anything. There's been, I think Nina Totenberg tried to suggest that it was a conservative clerk, but her analysis didn't have any connections to the reporters. It was just speculation about, well, a conservative clerk would have seen the strategic value of doing it this way because it fixes the justices in their positions.
Right, because conservatives are the ones who break the rules. That's what conservatives do, right?
Right, and also, what conservative clerk is going to subject their own justice to the kind of protests that we've been seeing at their houses? I mean, and they know that's coming. Yeah. You know, conservative clerks know what the left does, especially in this town, so I just don't see it. I think, as my analysis was from the beginning, this is probably the work of a desperate liberal law clerk trying to preserve Roe v. Wade. And then in that thread, I showed how this one particular clerk for Justice Breyer, Elizabeth Deutsch, not only has an extensive record through her career and her academic work of trying to work on pro-abortion, reproductive rights causes, and that Josh Gerstein, the journalist who published the leak
at Politico,
went to her wedding, co-wrote, was a shared bylines with her husband.
Yeah.
I mean, these people know each other. So, you know, I think the odds are still fairly high that it is
very, very impressive. Let's repost that thread right now. Guys, you need to read Will Chamberlain's. It's real journalism. Before we talk about big tech, you were the publisher at Human Events.
Yeah.
Fabulous a newspaper. For those who are not familiar with it, because it's like this silent conservative success story, say a little bit about Human Events before we move on to big tech.
Oh, sure, yeah. It was a Ronald Reagan favorite magazine, but it was basically defunct for about 5 years, from about 2014 to 2019. At the time, I bought it with Raheem Kassam and had him as EIC. We split pretty quickly, but I think we brought back kind of a little bit of a higher aesthetic. A lot of the early Human Events articles, especially when I was publishing, were, you know, really beautiful art from Ian Miles Chong, who's actually on Twitter. Most people know him just from his tweets, but you wouldn't know that he's actually a very talented graphic artist, and so much of the beautiful art that was on the articles was there. And we just had a lot of very good, interesting contributions. I was really trying to push the right towards this kind of more, almost like pragmatic ruthlessness in achieving things. And, you know, it kind of connects to big tech, because when I was on the aggressive action on big tech, bandwagon back in 2018, 2019, when most conservatives, I think, were still a little hesitant about trying to regulate it, because they come from this, you know, predisposition to
small government
type thing. And we were just really trying to push, no, that's a self-defeating principle. You can't, you know, let your small government biases allow Twitter to silence your constituents. That's not a good way to go. And I think, you know, in the end, you look back at some of those articles, and then you look at where people are now, 3 years later, you'll see that I think those articles were very influential.
We should actually spend a little time on the state of conservative media, because I think that's a very important topic. But before we move on to big tech, given this phrase you use, was it aggressive pragmatism?
Yeah, like I think sufficient ruthlessness is one of them.
Ruthlessness, okay. Yeah. So my devilish producer had an idea yesterday that we aired on the show with our listeners and viewers, that Steve Bannon and myself, given that, you know, the idea that a conservative clerk would release this Supreme Court decision and then put his employers and the conservatives at the mercy of these hounds baying outside their doors. We came up with the idea, or Jeff did, that Steve Bannon and myself should do an outside broadcast of our shows from Sotomayor's house this Friday. What do you think of that?
I mean, I think you're arrested if you do it, because sadly...
Wouldn't be the first time for Steve.
Right. Wouldn't be the first. True, in this case. But the problem, I mean, when it comes to stuff like this, you know, there's a double standard, obviously, right? But, you know, I like to say the double standard is always just an example of unexamined privilege, right? Like, that's, you know, we live in a two-tiered society, especially in politics, especially in D.C. So the stuff you can get away with in front of conservative justice's house, there's no way you'd get away with in front of a liberal justice's house. So... You got to be practical until we retake power, until we actually have like our people in charge of prosecuting cases.
All right, that idea is still out there. We shall see if Steve bites. I've texted him. We'll see if he texts me back at 3 a.m. Okay, let's return to big tech. Here's a little cut from the second richest man in the world, because, guys, it's actually Putin who's the richest. I mean, he literally has privatized half of Russia into his back pocket. So it's not on the books, but he is the richest man in the world. Elon Musk is a close second. And this is what he said at a recent TED talk. Cut one, play cut.
My strong intuitive sense is that having a public platform that is maximally trusted and broadly inclusive is extremely important to the future of civilization.
But you've described yourself.
I don't care about the economics at all.
Okay.
Richest man in the world, or second richest, says, I'm not in it for the money. Interesting. And he says it's vital for the future of civilization. Not exactly what you hear from liberals. We'll deal with the question of whether or not we trust this man, but give us the strategic analysis of how important a development is it that a guy who made his money out of PayPal, then electric vehicles, you know, a darling concept of the left, and then reinvigorating almost single-handedly America's space program, that this is the guy who wants to buy Twitter? How unusual is that, Will?
I mean, it's very unusual, especially because we're used to billionaires kind of hewing to the line of the left. Like, they're almost, they're scared as anybody else of the New York Times or the Washington Post writing a hit piece on them, which they shouldn't be because they're that wealthy. So it is really unique, and it's really, you know, gratifying, I guess would be the word, just to see someone step out and be willing to, despite how, you know, their high standing in elite circles, be able to say, no, this is just wrong. What you have been doing is completely wrong. And not only, I'm literally going to buy the biggest and most, not the biggest, but the most consequential and influential social media platform in the world to make sure that we, you know, this censorship stops.
Do you trust him? I mean, there's one metric that we've seen in the last month and a half, that the number of people who hate him now, who are the right people to have as your enemies, has multiplied like Topsy. So this is, you know, as you say, the hit pieces are coming from the establishment every couple of seconds. He's now gone on record to say that he's going to fire a lot of people. And he's gone on record in a tweet saying, yeah, Twitter is biased to the left. So does this add to his credibility, or is the jury still out, Will?
I think he has a lot of credibility here. I mean, the guy's has a lot of skin in the game.
Yeah.
He, you know, $20 billion of his own money. And he clearly would not have done this had Twitter been acting in a more free speech manner, right? There's no way. He has better things to do with his time and energy. He's got three or four other major companies and, you know, not enough time of the day as it is. So I think he's clearly doing this not out of, again, as he said, not out of economics, but out of a personal sense of this is wrong and I can fix it. And so I trust him as far as that goes. Now, will he be perfect? Will he be aligned with us on everything? Will he get rid of every instance of shadow banning and censorship? Probably not. But I think we can expect to see a dramatically more right-wing friendly Twitter in the world where Elon Musk buys it.
And the chances of it being sabotaged from the inside? before he gets to close the deal?
I mean, they're just pretty low at this point. There's no odds of some white knight left-wing buyer coming in because the company's economics don't make sense for, you know, a normal leveraged buyout where, you know, it's like a, you know, a company that's has a huge cash flow but is poorly run, like RJR Nabisco, so you can have a white knight come in and run it properly. Like, that's not Twitter. And so I don't see a white knight coming in. I don't see anybody wanting to get on Elon's bad side because of all his other, you know, important business interests. So I think this is going to ultimately go through.
We're talking to Will Chamberlain. You've got to follow him on Twitter. Read that thread. We've reposted it on the likely identity of the Supreme Court leaker. If you enjoyed this show as much as we love making it for you, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Go to Spotify. Plug in my name, Sebastian Gorka, America First. Write a little review. It does help with those dastardly algorithms. And share the links and guarantee for yourself that you never, ever miss an episode. If you haven't done so already, please join us. Register today for our Stand With Israel tour. We are traveling to the Holy Land with the director, no less, of 2,000 Mules. Yes, Dinesh D'Souza and his lovely wife will be joining us for 10 days later this year in Israel to walk literally where our Lord and Savior walked the earth. Even if you've been to Israel before, you haven't been with me and Dinesh. Reserve your tickets today. Call 855-565-5519 or just go to standwithisraeltour.com. Do it today. You won't regret it. I'm not vaccinated and I'm going. That's 855-565-5519. Standwithisraeltour.com. Standwithisraeltour.com. You've known it in your gut. Something just wasn't right about the 2020 election. Well, you were right. And here's the proof you've been waiting for. In Dinesh D'Souza's explosive new documentary, 2,000 Mules, you'll see jaw-dropping evidence of exactly how the Democrats pulled off the biggest heist in American history. Drawing on meticulous research from election integrity group True the Vote, 2,000 Mules uses both cell phone geo-tracking data and video evidence to uncover a massive network of illegal ballot trafficking in all five key swing states. Enough election fraud to change the outcome of the 2020 election. Thousands across the country attended the nationwide theatrical release. Now you can watch from the comfort of your own home. Watch on any device with a web browser. Gather friends, family, and skeptics alike, but don't miss it. See the movie President Donald Trump calls a real blockbuster. Go to salemnow.com to watch today. That's salemnow.com. Salemnow.com, sponsored by Salem Media Group. Okay, so social media. Let's look at the before the pre-Elon Musk situation. We have a cartel or a monopoly in most cases, whether it's Google, Alphabet, YouTube being one company, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. There have been clear instances of shadow banning, of a president being removed like that after an election. Up to now, the options that we've been given have been rather limited. It's removed their 230 immunity that they were provided in the 1990s so that they can be liable for what is published on their platforms or break them up. Where do you stand on these conservative recommendations? Is there one better than another, or does it have to be a combination, Will?
So I think that we'll take those in turn. So 230 immunity is tricky because I think there's two basic problems. One is...
Let's explain it first.
So 230 immunity is essentially saying that if you're a platform, you're not liable for what people post on your platform.
You're not a publisher. So
right.
The argument was, we're not the New York Times, we're not Fox, we're just a platform where anybody can put anything, therefore we're not liable for the content.
Right. Yeah, we're not exercising editorial responsibility.
Right.
So we shouldn't be liable for somewhat random, what one of our 300 million users says, even if it's defamatory or horrible rhetoric, you know, terrorist rhetoric or whatever. It's not, you know, we can't be held responsible for that. And so, you know, there's a good point to be said. It's like, wait, but you guys are acting with editorial authority when you delete posts,
they're
when
censoring.
You remove people. They're censoring.
They're making decisions that are editorial.
So at its core, there is a basic unfairness there. And so I guess I wouldn't say I'm opposed to removing or tailoring their 230 liability, but I'll make two points. One is when you do expand the liability protections that these companies face, they actually have to get more careful. Right, they have to think about censoring more. So that's one downside. They might be even more restrictive in the future. And the second is that removing their 230 protections, it doesn't redress the wrong that's been done to the victim of censorship.
Correct.
Right? Like, the victim of censorship still doesn't have their account, but then some third party who was defamed gets to sue them. Like, that's...
It doesn't put Donald Trump back on Twitter.
Right. 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 So it comes from the tendency, again, to try and find ways to achieve conservative goals by repealing existing laws or existing regulations, rather than implementing new ones that directly solve the problem.
Right.
Right? And so that's why I think it's tempting for a lot of conservatives to do that. Oh, we can still be small government and solve the censorship problem, but it isn't directly targeted at it. So that's the problem there. And the second thing you talked about was
breakup,
right? And I think in some companies, actually, probably, I'm for more severe antitrust laws. Like, there's some bipartisan antitrust reform that I think is generally good. But then, again, I don't think it all gets to the core of the censorship problem in particular, because, again, two main reasons. One is that I think these companies are kind of natural monopolies. Like, the network effects, like, you can't replace Twitter. You can't compete with Twitter, as we've learned over the past few years. Like, all the Twitter competitors have struggled mightily. And, you know, if Elon Musk, a brilliant businessman, he has the money to start a Twitter competitor. He didn't. He bought Twitter.
Are you saying that Truth Social is doomed then?
I think Truth Social is in bad shape. I think in a world, Truth Social's major competitive advantage was being a free speech platform in comparison to Twitter. And that's with Twitter's already existing advantages in terms of existing software, user base, etc. If Elon turns Twitter into a mostly free speech
then
platform,
there's no reason to have Truth Social.
Yeah, or any
unless it's avowedly the conservative Twitter.
Right, right. But even then, I mean, the fun part of Twitter is the fact that it's where everybody interacts, and so.
So let's unpack that prior point. So are you saying that because of the nature of the internet, the system of systems, the network of networks, that monopolies are kind of a natural byproduct?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the right way to look at it. The network effects, the more people are on your social media platform, the stronger it is, and the more of a competitive advantage it gets, which means you have this natural tendency towards consolidation. And, I mean, people will say, well, there's Facebook and Instagram, but Facebook and Instagram are owned by one company, and they're also, they're different. They're qualitatively different
services.
They serve
different functions.
Exactly. Yeah. And TikTok is not the same as Facebook. It's a different audience doing a different thing.
Right.
And so when you look at, there are people trying to compete with Twitter doing, text-based, public, square.
Mini blogs,
social media, and they're struggling completely. Yeah. And you know, they're not Instagram. And if you think, what's the other big photo-driven, centric social media platform other than Instagram? There isn't one, really.
Right.
So they're natural monopolies. So that's, my thesis then is that antitrust laws can only fix that so much, because you will inevitably end up with some amount of consolidation.
Well, and as somebody said to me, a wise person, if you do the Mar-Bell breakup and you turn it into lots of mini-bells, what is your expectation that the mini-bells won't be left-wing as well? Why would they naturally correct themselves? Why aren't you replacing, you know, one left-wing giant with 1,000 left-wing little mini blog sites?
Exactly. You can't make Silicon Valley not left wing, right? That doesn't solve the problem either. So
what about the last one? I should have mentioned at the top, and this is the public utility concept.
Yes.
That when you're on, when I pick up my phone, if I say something racist to, my friend on the phone, they can't take my phone away from me.
Mm-hmm.
Could we treat the social media environment as a public utility? Or then does the whole issue of liability come in?
No, that's exactly the way we should approach it, right? That's been my, and I almost look at it from like a civil rights perspective. I think the way we look at Facebook and Twitter as public accommodations, and in the 1960s, like, I'm not trying to compare the gravity of racial discrimination to censorship on social media. Obviously, that's much worse. But the basic logic works in a very similar way. You had a mass regime of private discrimination against Black Americans in the Jim Crow South, and you didn't say, well, build your own motels and build your own restaurants. Yeah. That was not adequate, and people looked at that and were like, that's wrong.
That's a very good point.
And so then the solution was national federal regulation to say you're just not allowed to discriminate in that way anymore. And I think that's the way, that's the way you make the government guarantees of freedom in the 14th Amendment meaningful, is you have to extend them to restricting private actors too. So same here, right? If the First Amendment is to be meaningful in 2022, you have to have the right to speak on the central town square of social media. And I think to make First Amendment rights meaningful, you need to say Americans just have a right to speak as long as they're engaged in lawful speech on these platforms.
Bingo. Talking of somebody who gets canceled and is under attack, a good friend of the president, good friend of the show is Mike Lindell. Please support him right now. MyPillow.com, 51 million pillows sold. President Trump loves them. My whole team uses them. Let's help this guy. He has your back. Let's have his. Up to 66% off if you use my name. Go right now to MyPillow.com, promo code G-O-R-K-A. That's MyPillow.com, promo code Gorka. Mike Lindell has a true passion to help everyone get the best sleep of their lives. Therefore, he created the Giza Dream bed sheets. They look and feel incredible, which translates to an even better night's sleep for you. Mike's latest amazing deal is the sale of the year. For a limited time, you will receive 60% off the Giza Dream sheets that come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. You'll receive a full set for as low as $39.99. And for a limited time, with any purchase, you'll receive Mike's soft cover book free when you use promo code G-O-R-K-A. Go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener square, and use promo code Gorka. Along with this offer, you'll also get deep, deep discounts on all his MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow towel sets, and so much more. Call 800-829-8468, promo code Gorka. Just go to MyPillow.com, promo code G-O-R-K-A.
And a good sign as to whether there is free speech is someone you don't like allowed to say something you don't like? And if that is the case, then we have free speech. And it's damn annoying when someone you don't like says something you don't like. That is a sign of a healthy, functioning free speech situation.
That is the definition of free speech. It's not speech you agree with. It's all speech, including speech that you find annoying. Thank you, Elon Musk. Exciting times to watch what is happening in social media. Will Chamberlain, one thing you mentioned is TikTok. What should people understand about TikTok? Who owns it? How dangerous it is? It's not Silicon Valley. It's even worse.
I think it's Tencent, or I might be somebody else, but it's there's a CCP-affiliated firm.
Yeah, it's Chinese, right.
Yeah, right, that has a lot of control over it. And, you know, I don't use TikTok. I generally think we should not use TikTok. I don't like Mark Zuckerberg that much, but I prefer him having access to my data than the Chinese Communist Party.
Right.
It seems like a pretty easy deal there. You know, we want American social media companies to be dominant. That is, I think, something else that is true about, you know, that means they're under the sovereignty of the American government, and we have a voice in how they're regulated and run themselves.
All right, let's pull out a little bit and let's talk about, given that you've published a seminal conservative newspaper, you're writing on social media. Let's talk about what the trend, and I need a sanity check from you, Will, because
okay.
I look at the last year, 9 months, and I identified one trend, and I don't want to read too much into it, so tell me if I'm wrong, but I may be in a conservative bubble, but I look at social media, I look at quote-unquote influencers, and I'm not talking about the Kim Kardashians, I'm talking about substantive influencers that talk about cultural issues, and I really only see three that when they say one thing or they post a 20-second clip, they've got 20, 30, 40 million likes within 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are Joe Rogan, Jordan Peterson, and Elon Musk.
Mm-hmm.
And the fascinating thing I see about those is that none of them are left-wing.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that Rogan is a Thatcherite conservative like me or a Reaganaut, but he's a pro-gun, pro-hunting, meat-eating libertarian who like Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. But let's say he's some kind of libertarian. Jordan Peterson, as far as I'm concerned, is a classic liberal with a small L. And then Musk, I think, has started to find a political identity in the last year and is creeping towards libertarianism. I don't think he's fully solidified, but he's definitely not a lefty because of his criticisms of Twitter. How significant? Am I seeing a trend that isn't there? And if I am, how significant is it that these are the three people? In other words, are conservatives, ironically, now the cool kids, Will?
Yeah, I would say the way to classify all three of those people is they're disaffected liberals in one way or another.
I like that.
Right, like they are, I think all three of them probably, well, Peterson's a Canadian, but all three would have voted for Obama, right, in 2008.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I think, and yet all three of them are hated by the current left, and would much be more easily classified as among the modern right wing. I think that it shows how much the, you know, the political spectrum has moved to make those people conservatives. And I think you have identified a trend, which is the people who really, there's a lot of very people who are really motivated to consume political content are people who are disaffected liberals themselves, who feel like bewildered by the way the left has just abandoned them,
yeah,
and are looking for a new political home. And so I think that, you know, from a conservative perspective, I wouldn't say that, like, these are red-blooded conservatives and they're Trump voters necessarily.
But also, isn't there an interesting aspect to all three of them, that they're not Ben Shapiro's, they're not Sebastian Gorka's, they're not going at a topic politically, mm-hmm, right? They don't come on, I'm going to talk about politics. No, yeah. I'm going to talk about Sasquatch and mythology, right? You know, mm-hmm. Peterson's going to do a lecture on, you know, the Odyssey, and Elon Musk's going to talk about Twitter. So these aren't political actors in the classical sense.
Right, but, you know, they're ultimately, there's, I think the left recognizes that there are political consequences to their arguments,
yes,
right? I think Peterson is really interesting in this way, because I think Peterson has what I would call a charitable secular reading of the Bible.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
he's a Christian who says, I can't admit to being a Christian. That's my biggest issue with him.
Right, right, sure.
I'm not good enough to say I'm a Christian.
Right, but I mean, I think the right should just let him do his thing,
yeah,
in that respect, because it's very valuable for somebody to be getting up there and say, you know, okay, so maybe you don't believe in every medical physical claim in the Bible, but look at all this fundamental ethical wisdom that's buried,
yeah,
in there, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think one of his most compelling points is that, you know, the Bible is also a compendium of our oldest stories, the stories we as humans co-evolved,
right,
with. And so that's why it still resonates so strongly today. And that's a way that kind of brings, you know, this is a whole separate conversation, but essentially all the people who were the new atheists of, like, the early 2000s, you know, if they were right-leaning at all, which many of them were, they now end up sort of not caring about the atheism anymore and are just kind of conservatives.
Right. And they're looking for a new home. You got to follow this guy, Will Chamberlain, at Will Chamberlain. He is senior counsel at the Article 3 Project, former publisher of Human Events. If you want to see something fascinating from the Supreme Court leak, look at the tweet that we retweeted just before we started talking about big tech. I want to get really big picture now, Will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was an advisor to candidate Trump. Mm-hmm. Then I ended up in his White House as a strategist to the president. And I guess now, I came out of the post office once and a little old lady stared at me and recognized me. And I didn't know whether it was going to be a crazy lib because we live in, you know, the swamp, mm-hmm, or not. And she said, You're Mr. MAGA. So I thought, that's great. So now on my bio on Truth Social, I said, yes, somebody once called me Mr. MAGA. Here's my problem with the MAGA movement and everything the president achieved is that it was almost an act of God. You know, Hillary Clinton outspent us 2-1. She spent at least $1.4 billion. The whole establishment was against President Trump. The GOP hated him. They still hate him. What is it? The Huffington Post said on the night of the election that Hillary has a 92% chance of winning.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we were dealing with President Trump. But he won. That's the remarkable thing. He won.
Mm-hmm.
In the intervening 5 years, I've seen attempts here and there, but I haven't seen a serious organic locus for the heavy lifting intellectually,
mm-hmm,
of what a MAGA conservative movement is.
Mm-hmm.
Because he just came in with the pragmatism of somebody who's, you know, building golden towers in Manhattan, mm-hmm, and golf courses in St. Andrews. And he said, okay, the border's broken, people are being overtaxed, and the swamp doesn't work. Let's fix it. It wasn't an ideological argument.
Mm-hmm.
It was you talked about pragmatism. It was a pragmatic approach. Talk to me about the deficiency of the heavy lifting, the intellectual heavy lifting for conservatives, the kinds of things that I think Human Events was about.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing because, I mean, you can over-intellectualize anything,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
But I think, you know, clearly there was a lot of intellectual force behind a few things. One was essentially the sort of new non-interventionist foreign policy.
Yes.
In many ways, it was, I think, a revenge of the kind of the young Ron Paul voters in 2008. They got older, and they changed their views on certain things like ISIS and jihadism, but the general resistance towards foreign intervention is still there. And so I think.
But again, if I may, because that was my field, was national security. It wasn't because we came in with a new theory of international relations. It's because a pragmatist comes in and says, we've got to stop these stupid wars, which was his phrase. So it wasn't a big intellectual new taxonomy. It was, this is dumb. $7 trillion? What are we talking about?
Yeah. No. And I think the war in Iraq really shaped, like, I look at my generation, like, the war in Iraq really shaped us because we were naturally right-wing, right? Yeah. Like, I think people sort of have a right-wing or a left-wing temperament at the end of the day. Most people, you know, one or the other. But if you're a young right-winger growing up in 2000, you know, turning 18 or something in 2003, then you're seeing Iraq and you're being told by the elder people in your movement, like, this is what you need to support.
Right.
And then you look at it and it goes terribly. And not only does it go terribly, the people who advocated for it suffer no career consequences. Like, think of a Bill Kristol. I mean, he was dominant in the Republican Party for years,
yes,
well after, and it finally was Trump in 2016 that did him in. But I think that there's, so that's a big part of, I think, the MAGA movement is sort of that generation of people who felt really jilted by Republicans in the 2000s coming back and saying, no, we are conservative people. We're just not for these silly interventions. And then I think there's the second part of it, which is, you know, this more heterodox economics, which is, you know, it's not socialist, but it's saying things like, why do we have to export all the jobs in Ohio overseas?
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense. And it feels like we're not really taking care of American citizens first.
The hillbilly elegy argument.
Yeah.
Killing two generations of manual laborers in America.
Yeah, for these trade deals that, you know, just enriched a few people, but, like, just destroyed the industrial base of our country.
Right.
Like, that's not good. That can't be seen as good.
But you're describing the logic of MAGA then.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, have we done enough as thinking conservatives after the 16 victory to put flesh on the bones?
No, I don't think we have. And I think partially, it's because we've been in this defensive crouch. You know, I would say that, you know, as much as my work on tech is about, you know, encouraging offensive moves to protect conservatives, the fact that we're even doing that, we're literally just fighting for our right to speak.
Correct.
You know,
it's a rearguard action.
It's a rearguard action. And so we're just, you know, right now we've been so desperately trying to fight that. I think that putting forward a really robust intellectual program hasn't happened yet. That's not to say it won't. There's plenty of time to do it now. And
really?
I think we can get it done. I mean, maybe not the full thing, but we can get a lot done in the next 2 years, I think, is prior to either the next Trump presidency or the next Republican.
And are you seeing people making an effort? I mean, I love the guys at AmericanGreatness.com, Chris Buskirk. There's also a conference that an Israeli has been doing. I can't remember.
Yoram Hazony, yeah. I'm
Hazony
a good friend
of him. On nationalism or modern nationalism. So are you seeing glimmers?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm very encouraged by what I see at the Hozoni conference. Yoram's a friend. I'm actually reviewing. He's got a book coming out that I'm going to be reviewing, Conservatism, a Rediscovery. It's very, very good. I like the American Conservative is doing excellent work, in my judgment. There's a new magazine called Compact by Sohrab Ahmari. You've got guys like Adrian Vermeule, who's, I think, a fascinating Harvard Law School professor, put out a book called Common Good Constitutionalism that's sort of... there's a lot of really good intellectual ferments going on the right. I think, you know, developing into a full, complete program by 2024, probably challenging. But I think we'll be in a much better position than we were, and than President Trump was in 2016, where he had won office on this mandate to put in place an America First platform. But what was the list of 2,000 people he was going to hire to staff all the agencies that agreed with him? He didn't have anything like that. And I think, you know, much of the story of President Trump's first term is these really great successes on foreign policy, where so much of, you know, the responsibility falls on him as the president, and then these difficult struggles with the bureaucracy and the deep state.
Who refused to actually implement.
Right, exactly. So, you know, that's, you know, I mean, and you know, some of that falls on him. He ultimately is the chief executive with some firing and hiring authority. But I think, you know, if the lessons are learned for 2024, I think things can get, you know, much better.
And the relationship, we'll talk about the deep state in a second, but the relationship of the establishment, the GOP to him?
Yeah.
That's unfixed.
Yeah, it's still unfixed. And, I mean, I think, you know, something as simple as, you know, yesterday's vote to send $40 billion to Ukraine when there's baby formula shortages all over the country. Like, we have not done enough work. You know, no Democrats voted against that. So, you know, the idea that there's any sort of non-interventionist part of the Democrat Party, that's over. AOC voted for it. Ilhan Omar said voted for $40 billion in military aid to Ukraine. But we only had 57. We need to get more. I mean, I think they should have been resistant to sending that money until we had an investigation into exactly why Hunter Biden was getting paid so much.
As Bannon put it, it is the Uniparty. This is America First One-on-One, and we are coming to you from the ReliefFactor.com studio. So just this week, we reported that the DOD is trying to take Michael Flynn's pension away from him, or to dock part of his pension because of his lunch with Putin in Moscow when he was actually working for the DIA, collecting intelligence, which he brought home to give to the U.S. government. So here's the big question for you, Will. In what you've witnessed in the last 5 years, maybe we can deal with the GOP, maybe the swinging successes for the midterm Republican MAGA candidates will be enough when it comes to party politics. But what about the deep state? Do you think a second Trump term can, MAGA can grapple that thorn?
Maybe. It depends. And that's actually going to be on Trump and the people he hires at personnel, you know, and he has to do a better job than he did in the first term. Yeah. Right. Like, I think, you know, I want to preface this. I really like President Trump. I think he's a great president,
I've said this again and again and again. I don't care what you think is the most important part of MAGA, whether it's the borders, whether it's the economy, whether it's the First Amendment, whether it's pro-life. I really don't care which one is the most important to you. If we don't fix personnel, it doesn't matter.
Right. And I want to stress that, you know, remember, he one thing, his worst habit, I would say, is publicly, when he was president, was complaining publicly about his direct subordinates because he had firing authority over them. Right. You know, that's terrible management any way you cut it. Like, if you don't like what your subordinate is doing, tell them privately. Right. Don't blast them on Twitter.
It's one of the great ironies of the man whose TV show hit phrase for 14 years was, "You're fired." And I'm not talking out of school here. He hates to fire people.
Yeah.
Face to face.
Yeah.
He just hates to.
Yeah. No. And I mean, I think that's very human of him in a sense, right? Like he's not some robot. Like, he's a human being. But but that said, I think, you know, if he has to... It's really important that he learns the lesson of his first term, right? There, and I will be very frustrated if I see more whining about his subordinates and how terrible they were, right? Like, at a certain point, like, if every subordinate you hired for a certain position was a loser and useless and whatever, well, that's on you. You're the executive who hired them.
And if you don't like him, call him in and fire them.
Right, and hire somebody to fix it. So I think he – but if he learns that lesson, I mean, there's so much potential to be unlocked. And I think, you know, J.D. Vance might have said it, Blake Masters might have said it, like, you know, we just need to start firing a lot more people early on.
Bingo.
Right?
And get the departments out of D.C. I don't want if we have to have a Department of Agriculture, move it to North Dakota. Take the State Department and send it to, you know, Anchorage. We've been talking to Will. No, seriously, because only
that
patriots
would be perfect.
Will work there.
It's closer to Russia.
Exactly. We've been talking to Will Chamberlain. This has been One-on-One. Dear friends, don't forget, 2,000 Mules. You can watch it tonight. Go to salemnow.com, sponsored by the Salem Media Group. I have a stake in it because it is that important a movie. That is 2,000 Mules by Dinesh D'Souza, salemnow.com. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, keep your head in a swivel. Watch your six. Hold the line. Never give up. Never give in. And stay frosty.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.